As a society, we've become more and more disconnected with our food source, but there's a process called community-supported agriculture that works to connect you, the consumer, with local farmers. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury, in for Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and joining us are Richard Duran of Iowa State University Extension Horticulture and Linda Nave of Iowa State University Value Added Agriculture. Along with community-supported agriculture, we'll also be talking about how the cold winter weather we've experienced this March will affect the planting season. We'll also be taking your questions. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Emily Woodbury, in for Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, the first Horticulture Day of spring, although it doesn't quite feel like it, does it? Highs in the 20s and 30s when just last March we were experiencing temperatures in the 70s and 80s. We'll be talking today about how this cold, snowy weather will affect the planting season. With us today is Richard Duran from Iowa State University Extension Horticulture. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
And Linda Nave is also here. She's with the Iowa State University Extension Value Added Agriculture Program. Good morning, Linda.
Good morning.
We'll talk with you, Linda, in a few minutes about community-supported agriculture and how you can access food from farmers in your area. But first, let's discuss what this cold weather means for spring planting. So, for most plants, you start seeds and sprouts in the ground around the end of March and throughout the month of April. Is this weather going to delay the process, Richard?
We think so, probably by a week or two. Last year, according to the records in Des Moines, the temperature on March 17th was 83. Then we had 83, 81, 68, 69, and 67. And this year, on the same dates, we had highs of 41, 36, 41, 30, and 38. So it's been quite a bit cooler. Plants were about 3 to 4 weeks ahead of schedule last year. And so we had things blooming at this time of year last year, like daffodils and tulips. But this year, everything is probably behind maybe a week or two.
Mm-hmm. And is this only an issue when the weather fluctuates? Or, like, are we going to be okay if it's cold and then it suddenly gets warm and stays warm?
Actually, this is much better than last year. We had fruit trees blooming in early to mid-April. Then we had the freezing temperatures around April 10th and 11th. And that actually destroyed much of the fruit crop in Iowa as for the apples. And this year, the fruit trees are still basically fully dormant. So they shouldn't be blooming, I wouldn't think, until maybe at the earliest, late April, early May. So that's good for them. So at that point, at time of year, a late frost or freeze is much less likely at that time of year.
Mm-hmm. And what has this late snowfall done for the ground? Is this going to be beneficial?
I think it has been. Some of that has soaked in, so that's beneficial. So maybe some snow this weekend might actually be good in that regard.
And so for anxious gardeners out there, what can they get done in the meantime?
Probably not much outside. Possibly they could do some pruning yet. As far as pruning shade trees, fruit trees, raspberries, grapes, that type of thing. So they can do that. They can start some seed indoors possibly. But as far as planting things outside, maybe in another week or two possibly. It's supposed to be in the 30s and 40s next week. That's not very conducive to planting either. So
no, and we have to get this frost out of the ground first because we still have frost going somewhat deeper than we usually do. And It hasn't been bad, though. I mean, just because winter's extended doesn't mean it's going to affect our plants adversely. Actually, it's really a pretty good deal.
Sure, it just affects our mood for now.
Yes.
Right.
So, Linda, you're here today to talk about a process where individuals can have access to fresh, straight from the farm food, no matter what the temperature. It's called community-supported agriculture, and it's a trend that's growing here in Iowa. Can you tell us a little bit about the process?
Well, community-supported agriculture, it's often referred to as CSAs. They first started in the United States about 25 years ago. The first one was actually in Massachusetts in 1984. And the government doesn't really track the numbers of CSAs, but there's an unofficial count that says there's about 4,000 or more than 4,000 CSAs now that have sprung up over the course of 25 years in the United States. And it's a very simple concept. The name sounds a little odd, community-supported agriculture, but when you think about the nuts and bolts of the program, you'll understand why it's called that. And thousands of families have joined CSAs to get the fresh straight from the farm vegetables that the CSA offers. So here's a little bit about the basics of a CSA. A farmer offers a certain number of shares of their farm to the public, to individuals in the community.
Like a company?
Yeah, kind of, but not in a way, yes. You own a share. In other words, if the farmer has a certain size farm that accommodate 80 shares, that means the produce is divided up between those 80 individual shares. Some offer half shares and full shares, but for the full shares, it's a share of the farm. And typically, the share is a box of vegetables that come along. Now, if the grower harvests 160 pounds of tomatoes and he has 80 shares, then two tomatoes per share. So that's kind of how it's divided up. Now that is, and if it's a really good year, there are more products in that box or bag for the consumers that buy that. And then on a year where maybe it's a little stressful due to heat, heavy rains, hail, the bag might be less. That is the risk that the individual is buying into. So there is a lot of advantages and some challenges associated with a CSA.
What types of products are in these boxes?
You know, that's a good question. Most often you think of produce in those bags or boxes, fresh fruits and vegetables, seasonal vegetables, for example, early in the season it might be lettuce, radishes, green onions. Mid-season it could be zucchini, other summer squash, tomatoes, peppers, onions, and then you get into the fall crops. But more and more we're seeing other types of CSA springing up or a combination of things. For example, my daughter on the East Coast in Boston, she subscribes to a meat CSA in which there are a number of farmers that work together to provide this CSA. Some are poultry farmers and some raise beef or pork, and then they work together to provide this meat CSA. Now, some growers are working with others that provide both vegetables and meats in the CSA. Some provide eggs, some provide fresh flowers. So it varies. So it's not just produce, it's other farm fresh vegetables, vegetables and locally produced meats.
Sure. And when we're talking about locally produced food and fresh vegetables, one of the things in Iowa, you know, we have a couple food deserts and maybe some socioeconomic levels don't have access to fresh, healthy food. Is CSA membership affordable? Is this something that's available to all Iowans?
I can't say that exactly. It depends on the individual farmer. Some have opportunities where you can work at the farm to subsidize the cost of the CSA. You put in so many hours and you get so much dollar credit towards your CSA. So that's an opportunity to bring that cost down.
And where can people find CSAs in their area?
There's a few places that they can go to find out where there is a CSA and how much they cost and get the details on that. Probably the most popular location to find this that have several and the most extensive registration is called localharvest.org, all one word, localharvest.org. You go on there and click on Iowa or your county, and you can find the farmers that do offer CSAs. There is another more local one provided by Iowa State University called marketmakeriowa.com, where farms have registered and put their information on Market Maker, and it brings the customer, whether it be an institution, a business, or a consumer, in touch with the farmer. Mm-hmm. That's called marketmakeriowa.com. And another source would be the regional and local Buy Fresh, Buy Local campaigns. If you just Google Buy Fresh, Buy Local Iowa, you'll find the different chapters, and you can see their latest flyer that talks about the different farms and the farmers that are registered with Buy Fresh, Buy Local. So there are a number of different places you can go to find out where the CSAs are in your area.
So let's say I sign up for a CSA right now. What types of things am I going to find in there? And, you know, sometimes, you know, there might be things that we don't know what to do with, how to cook it? Is there, do they ever send information on what to do?
Well, that's one of the advantages of a CSA. You get the ultra-fresh vegetables with a great flavor because they were just picked that day or the day before, and you get exposed to new and different vegetables. Many CSAs offer some type of a newsletter or website that the shareholder can go to find recipes, how to cook those vegetables that may be a little bit unusual for them. And CSA's farmers have reported that they've gotten a lot of people to step out of the box and try something new, whether it be Swiss chard, edamame, or whatever, that they'd never ventured out to buy at the farmer's market. But if it's in their CSA bag, they have a recipe, they're willing to try it.
You and Richard, have you ever joined a CSA, and what's the weirdest thing you've ever found in a box?
Well, from what I understand, probably edamame would have been the most unusual that some people find in their box. Others will find rutabagas that they don't often get, or they'll find unusual varieties of peppers or tomatoes or rainbow carrots or colorful beets. So as far as unusual, you're talking to horticulture people here, so we don't know too much unusual because we've been exposed to a lot of this. But for the general public, those would be some of the more unusual things.
Sure, I understand they also send items as well. You know, like knitting and crafts, that sort of thing.
That would be more for the farmer's market rather than the CSA. CSAs are pretty much the freshly produced food products. Now, once in a while, they'll add flowers to that CSA mix just for something nice. But overall, it's mostly the food, not the craft or even baked items are usually not a common sight in a CSA box. We haven't talked much about the benefits to the farmers to offer a CSA. And there are significant benefits to a small-scale farmer to grow CSAs. And there are some limitations as well. One is the farmer can market their product long before the season starts. Usually the CSA advertisements go out in January. You can start signing up as early as then. And what that does is it allows the farmer to spend more time in his field than in the marketing of his product. And it also, when the consumer or the shareholder buys the CSA, they buy it at least in full or half of it ahead of time in April or March. And so that farmer can use that cash up front to buy the seeds, to help get his farm established, mulch, other things, to get it going. So it helps with the family farm cash flow.
Mm-hmm. Community-supported agriculture sounds like a great thing for everyone in your community. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. Linda Nave of Iowa State Extension Value-Added Agriculture and Richard Duran of Iowa State University Extension Horticulture. They'll both be here, and they are ready to answer your questions. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or write on our Facebook page. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Linda Nave of Iowa State Extension Value Added Agriculture and Richard Duran of Iowa State University Extension Horticulture. Thank you both for being here. So before we went into the break, we were talking about community-supported agriculture. If you yourself have joined a community-supported agriculture program, give us a call at 866-780-9100. We want to hear about your experience. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, and you can also post to our Facebook page. Again, the number to call with planting questions, comments about CSAs is 866-780-9100. Now, one thing I want to talk about this year is vegetable planting and kind of unique vegetables. Can you give us an idea of some maybe unique vegetables that the novice gardener can plant? You know, everyone, it's very common to plant tomatoes, but what are some other things that we can plant in Iowa?
Well, what I would suggest as far as unique are those vegetables that you cannot readily purchase at the grocery store that you may see at the farmer's market, but maybe not. And these are the vegetables that may be of a different type or a different variety of the ones you are familiar with. And I mentioned earlier some of the things you might find in a CSA bag that's a little different that you don't ordinarily get at the grocery store are the colorful carrots or the yellow beets or the white radishes. These are common vegetables, but they're in a different color or a different little different flavor, and it adds a lot to the color palette of your food when you're serving it to your family. So again, rainbow carrots, the yellow beets, the white icicle radishes that have a flavor all their own compared to the red satin, round, typical red ones that we see. So some differences in that. If you look now, many varieties of tomatoes are on the market that aren't your traditional round, red, standard tomatoes that are associated with what we see at the grocery store. You can combine that with other colorful varieties such as the yellow pears, the little yellow pears that are a novelty item. Combine it with a yellow tomato, yellow fruited tomato. You'll find the flavor is outstanding on many of these yellow varieties. A little lower in acid. They have a little more sugar content. So it masks the acidity in that tomato variety. And peppers are another one you can find. A whole rainbow of colors of different peppers that you may see the reds, the yellows, the oranges, and the greens in the grocery store, but you can get white, you can get creamy colored peppers that also have that very sweet flavor, almost jump out at you in sweetness as compared to the standard bell peppers. So these are a few of our common vegetables that that are just a little different variation of those. Some of the less grown common things that you might have in a garden are maybe step out of the box with your leafy greens. You might want to try planting arugula, different types of spinach. You have the Savoy type or the crinkled leaf or the flat leaf. You have massive different lettuce blends on the market now that may contain some Asian greens, Mizuna, and some other things that all add to the flavor of your lettuce salad mix. And these are the type of things that you won't be able to get at a local grocery store.
Mm-hmm. And when we're talking about vegetable gardens, one thing that comes to mind versus, you know, planting a flower bed and a vegetable garden is making a vegetable patch more attractive. A few weeks ago in West Des Moines, they were considering a ban on front yard vegetable gardens for this very reason. Is there any way to make this garden more attractive?
I think I am very biased, but I think a vegetable garden is very attractive, provided you keep the weeds out. In any garden situation, regardless if it's a vegetable garden or a flower garden, if the weeds get out of hand, it's not going to be an attractive situation in the neighborhood. But vegetable gardens, you add a row of green beans, you add some beets, colorful beets, some Swiss chard, lettuce, other greens, and your tomato plants flowering. Okra is a hibiscus type flower. It's beautiful. Again, it has to do with the maintenance of that garden. And it's amazing if when you have a vegetable garden, how it attracts individuals to see and come and see what you are growing, learn a little bit about what that gardener is doing. So I got to say I'm more of an advocate towards vegetable gardens in a home landscape. Richard, do you have any comments on that? Richard kind of tends to agree with me. And
it all depends upon how it's maintained. Mm-hmm. That's the key point. Yeah.
Yes.
Now, Nathan from Cedar Rapids has a question. He called 866-780-9100. Hello, Nathan.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you? Yeah. What's your question today?
Okay. Well, it doesn't necessarily pertain to maybe what we're talking about today, but I was out surveying the backyard, and a few maple trees and elm trees and birch trees that I planted a couple years ago have deer scrapes on them.
Okay.
And I had read a few things on, you know, the best way to protect them and or at least keep them. And I wondered what your opinion was.
Well, at this point, you can't really do much as far as helping the trees recover. They're going to have to do that on their own. What you can do is in the fall, go out with some wooden stakes or fence posts and pound those in around the tree, about three in a triangle, and place those about 18 inches apart. And that way in the fall, they can't get their head in there to try to rub the antlers on that tree. So that's what you want to do in the fall of the year. Basically, that should be done probably by mid to late September. Most of the damage occurs in the fall of the year.
Now, Roger from Duncombe has another tree question. Hi, Roger.
Yes, Richard, this is Roger. I have a butternut tree that I planted when I came home from Vietnam, which was about 40-some years ago, maybe a little more than that. Mm-hmm. And she survived, but her compatriot didn't. She got cowed.
Okay.
We had cattle get out in the yard. So I want to know, should I go ahead and plant another one now when they're talking about this disease that is affecting the butternut?
Well, the problem there is that by themselves, oftentimes, nut trees are not very productive. So that one tree may be fine and healthy, but it may not produce much in the way of crop. Yes, there is a problem with the disease on the butternuts, and so that's a concern also. So there's not an easy answer to that question. If you want to have a nice tree, the butternut is a nice tree, it may just not produce well, unfortunately.
And just to call again, you can call with all of your horticulture questions today at 866-780-9100. Sally from Marshalltown is a member of a CSA, and she had a great experience. Tell us about that, Sally.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Hi, Linda. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Sally.
Many of my friends have had are farmers that had CSAs, and after trying to grow vegetables myself a few times, I'm not the best vegetable grower, so I decided I should really buy them from people who knew how to grow them. So I joined a CSA last year for my family with a young man who was growing things in a community garden at our community college, and it was fantastic. Tried all kinds of vegetables I had never tried before.
And what were some of those vegetables, Sally?
Well, collard greens. I had never tried collard greens before. Mustard greens. I wasn't much of a kale person, and I just eat kale by the boatload now. And beets of various kinds. I always thought beets tasted like dirt, but that's because the ones that you usually buy in the store do. But the fresh ones and these different heirloom varieties are really much more delicious. Radishes. I never liked radishes before, but because they were so fresh and such, you know, varieties that you just don't find anywhere else, they were the most flavorful ones. And I'm learning to like just about every kind of vegetable now.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much for your call, Sally. And Jeff in Des Moines has a question about CSAs. Potential risks. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good. What's your question?
Well, my question is, what are some of the risks associated with buying into a CSA or belonging to a CSA? You know, I understand we live in a state where there's an abundance of wildlife, and, you know, the weather doesn't always cooperate with growing seasons. And I was just kind of wondering what some of the risks were associated with, and I can take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Thanks, Jeff.
Jeff, that is a really good question, and we didn't go into that in our earlier discussion, so I'm really glad you brought it up. There are certain risks associated with a CSA. As buying part of a share of the farm, you are also buying into the risks of that farmer. You have to put your faith and trust that that farmer will, to the best of his ability or her ability, produce a crop and a sustainable crop to provide enough produce to make it worth your investment. It is a risk. Now, it's the risk is also such that, let's say you pay $240 for a 12-week CSA, and you're expecting some beautiful peppers and tomatoes in the middle of the summer, and it hails, and those crops are destroyed. Well, you, in many cases, the CSA shareholder does lose a little bit on his investment because there's not the peppers or the tomatoes that the farmer said he would be able to produce. That's an act of nature. It's difficult to do. Now, sometimes you may run into a situation where it's a new CSA producer and they really are inexperienced in growing a number of crops to have available over a long extended period of time. And that individual may not be able to follow through on some of their crops. So growing a CSA is not for beginners. It takes a certain skill set, certain amount of experience to grow vegetables, to have them available for the given number of people over a specified period of time. So you do invest in that, and you do take the risk along with the farmers.
Thank you so much for your call, Jeff. Gary in Clive has a question. Hi, Gary.
Hello. Good afternoon. Hey, I had a question. I hear you're supposed to rotate the garden, you know, move the tomato plants from year after year. And is that true? And also, if I till it up real good, I mean, will that make a difference?
Well, you want to rotate basically for concerns as far as insects and disease. Many plant diseases are plant-specific, and they also can persist in the soil maybe 2 or 3 years. So where you had tomatoes last year, if they had some type of foliar disease like Septoria leaf spot, and you put them back in the same area, they're most likely to get it again. So if you can, you want to rotate and put your tomatoes where they haven't been grown for at least 2 or 3 years, ideally. So that's the key there, is to try to cut down on the incidence of disease by simply rotating your crops
and
as
Richard,
best you can.
Is that more important for heritage varieties versus conventional hybrids?
As far as many of the foliar diseases, they're fairly common on both the hybrids and the heirloom varieties. So it's important for both. Many of the hybrids are wilt resistant, but they're not blight resistant.
And now we have another good CSA experience, a happy CSA customer. Hi, Ann from Mason City. How you doing?
Oh, I'm fine.
And so what was your experience like?
Well, I do have a small vegetable garden as well, but I belong to One Step at a Time Gardens out of Clemmy, and I've had nothing but good experience. And yes, I have experienced some of the lower productivity of the garden, but that is expected. All of our vegetables have been excellent, and it's like a box of Christmas vegetables every week, so we really enjoy our CSA.
That's great. Thank you so much for your call, mm-hmm. Anne. And we're taking all of your horticulture questions. Oh, I'm sorry. Linda, do you have a comment?
Yes, Emily. She brought up a great point, because one of our CSA producers says that they deliver to the home and to the businesses rather than a pickup site. And he says that when he stops at some of the homes with young children, the children are so excited to see what's in that CSA bag, and they are more likely, they know the farmer, they've met the farmer who grew their food for them, and the parents report that although children hadn't eaten specific vegetables before, when they see it in the CSA bag and they're excited to get that bag, they're anxious to try whatever's in that bag. So it can help young families get kids more interested in eating fresh vegetables. The flavor is so much better, and the freshness, and the fact that they know where that food came from.
Mm-hmm. So this can really be a teaching experience for parents.
It can. And some farms, not all farms, will open up their farm on a day or two and have an open house so that the families can actually come out and see where their vegetables are produced.
And we have Jan in Iowa City. Good morning, Jan.
Good morning. Last year, not this year, but over the winter last year, I did sheet mulching, and I was very excited with the quality of the compost I got on, you know, a nice rich layer all over my garden. And then I commute to my garden, and during the summer, I had to replace my car, and I couldn't get out there to keep it mulched and weeded. So as a result of my composting efforts, I have the best crop of weeds I've ever seen. And I don't know quite how I'd like to transition to no-till, but I'm kind of stymied as to how to deal with these extremely robust weeds that are, you know, dried and standing in the garden.
Thank you, Jan.
I would probably go out and remove that debris as best you can. Either with a mower or something, get rid of that debris as best you can, and till it. And then later on, once you have things planted, then I would use mulches to control the weeds. Things like grass clippings, shredded leaves, pine needles, straw, to basically cut back a lot on the actual weeding. I'm sure because the weeds grew last year, that they produced a lot of weed seed. So there's going to be a lot of weed seed in that soil, and you have to make sure that you try to prevent as much germination as possible this coming growing season. So that would be my suggestion, is to cut back or destroy all that dead debris, get it out of there as best you can, and then till it and then use mulches.
If I want to get away from tilling, maybe I can't this year, but is there any possibility of burning it off, or is that not productive?
Well, you have to be careful on that as far as burning. I would be inclined not to, because sometimes they can get out of control, and then you're calling the fire department. And so I would prefer not to, I think, in that case.
Even after you've cleared the debris out?
Oh, if you've cleared the debris, then there's no need to burn, I wouldn't think.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Jan. Jan called 866-780-9100. We're talking community-supported agriculture today, but we're taking all of your horticulture questions as well. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. Linda Knave of Iowa State Extension Value-Added Agriculture is here, as well as Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture. They'll both be here, and they are ready to take your questions. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, and you can post on our Facebook page. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Charity Nebbe. Charity Nebbe will be back on Monday with home improvement expert Bill McAnally. We'll be talking about home improvement, but today it is Horticulture Day, and with me, Linda Knave of Iowa State Extension Value-Added Agriculture. Thanks for joining us, Linda.
Thank you.
And Richard Duran of Iowa State University Extension Horticulture. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And you're welcome to join our conversation as well. We're talking about community-supported agriculture. So if you've joined a CSA, you enjoyed it, you can call. If you have just regular horticulture questions, we're taking those calls as well. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, and you can also post to our Facebook page. First, calling in, John, he is on the road. He wants to talk about changes in weather with CSAs. Hi, John. Good morning.
Good morning. Last year, we had our first CSA experience, and it was wildly successful, I thought. But I know that there was a lot of people saying that there were a lot less produce in the boxes last year because of the drought. And, you know, I think that's, you know, something as well. You know, you spoke about if there's a hailstorm or something like that and the crop is destroyed, you might not get some of the produce that you were expecting. But, you know, the way I saw it was, you know, both were sharing the risk as well as, you know, it wasn't just that farm that experienced the drought. So, you know, supply and demand basically says that if there's less supply, the demand is higher. So I didn't feel like I lost money, quote unquote. I just felt like I paid, you know, the going rate for organic or naturally grown sustainable produce, which I thought was worth every penny that we paid for it.
That's a very good point, that supply and demand and your cost just went up a little bit because you didn't get the quantity that maybe you could have expected under a, if there's ever such a thing, normal growing season. Some of the things, other factors that affect production might be the heat. Last spring, we get summer real quickly, so the spring crops may have not been near as prolonged as the farmer had expected. So maybe the lettuce wasn't in as ample a supply. Maybe the radishes came and went real quickly and things like that. Again, that's beyond the farmer's ability to control.
We have an email from a happy CSA member in Waverly, Iowa. Corey says, we have belonged to the Genuine Faux Farm CSA for several years and love the variety and amounts of produce we receive from them. Nothing but great things to say about belonging. Thanks for your email, Corey. And next up, we have Brandon in Webster City. Hi, Brandon. What's your question?
Well, hi. My question is, I'm growing ground cherries for the first time this year, and I have them started in some flats with my tomatoes and everything, and my tomato seedlings and pepper seedlings are coming up very strong, very healthy, and very, you know, vibrant. But the ground cherries seem to be struggling, and I know they're really tiny as they are, but I've had a lot just damp off, but I was thinking maybe it's damping off disease, but it's not happening to anything else. And I know they're in the tomato family, and I read it says that they prefer the same conditions, but they don't seem to be preferring the same conditions right now.
So the seedlings are coming up, but then they're collapsing and dying?
They're coming up really leggy, and then a lot of them are falling over. I got a couple that are doing okay. But
if you can, as soon as they come up, put those seedlings under artificial light, like a fluorescent shop fixture.
Sure.
And,
well, I have them under a T5 right now.
Okay. But give them as much light as you can so they don't become tall and lanky.
Sure.
And once they come up, also kind of cut back a little bit on the watering. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Because very wet conditions tend to encourage things like damping off. So once they come up, they do need a damp or moist environment to germinate, but once they come up, let it dry out a little bit before you water again.
Well, sure. Okay.
All right. Thanks for your call, Brandon. Up next is Scott in Fort Madison. Hi, Scott.
Hello. Good morning.
Morning.
My wife has found an ad in a magazine for Zoysia grass.
Okay.
And we're living in southeast Iowa, and it's gotten a lot drier, and our lawn has suffered terribly. And I just wondered what you thought of Zoysia grass.
Well,
got a lot of sun.
Yeah, Zoysia grass is different than the typical bluegrass lawn. Bluegrass is a cool season grass, so it does green up early in the spring, typically April.
Mm-hmm.
Zoysia grass is a warm season grass. So in a few weeks, you can drive by neighborhoods, and you can immediately spot Zoysia grass because it's still brown. It typically greens up fairly late in the spring. And then it's basically green all summer. And then it turns brown fairly early in the fall also. So you can definitely identify it in the spring and fall because it's basically brown at that point. The other thing is that it tends to spread and it's very hard to maybe control or contain. So it possibly could move into your neighbors. The neighbors may not want it or like it, and it's very hard to control. So you should be aware of that. And if you do establish it, and then let's say 2 or 3 years later, you decide you really don't like it, it's very, very hard to get rid of or destroy. It may take a year or so to get rid of it. So there are some good things and some bad things. It is on the good side, it is extremely drought tolerant. It is heat tolerant, so that's not a problem. It will grow in Iowa, so those are things that you can benefit from. But there are some drawbacks, too. So be aware of the good things and the bad things.
Very good. Thank you.
Thanks, Scott. Well, speaking of drought-resistant plants, you know, we were talking about vegetable plants earlier that you can grow in Iowa. Are there specific vegetables that will be really good to plant this year if we have another summer like last?
Well, basically, when you plant a garden, you should probably do that with a thought that if it doesn't rain, I'm going to have to go out there and water. That's just kind of a given. But to cut down on your watering, you can mulch. And mulching is very, very beneficial. If you have bare ground, it's amazing how quickly that soil dries on a sunny, windy day. So if you cover that with some grass clippings, shredded leaves, straw, that helps a lot as far as the plants are concerned. So that would be my thought that if I'm concerned about a drought this coming year, make sure I have some mulching materials around to mulch the garden.
Mm-hmm. Janice in Cedar Rapids has a question about planting indoors. Hi, Janice.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about a Christmas cactus plant that I have put outside in the summer. And it had some volunteer friends join it when I brought it back in, and so now it's half filled with Christmas cactus and half with impatiens plants. And I've just noticed something interesting about it, and so I wanted to call and ask if there's a genetic thing that could be happening. is that my Christmas cactus now seems to be blooming with a few blossoms at a time, almost like the impatience. And I just haven't, I've had this plant for probably 10 years, and before that, it would bloom when I brought it in the fall prolifically, and then that was done until the next year.
Well, so, that's a coincidence. There's no relationship there as far as between the two plants. The Christmas cactus is a short day plant. And in the fall of the year, as the days get shorter, that triggers flowering.
Yeah.
But they also will sometimes bloom in late winter, early spring, as the days are getting longer. Again, it's at day length, which kind of triggers blooming.
Okay.
So they will sometimes bloom in mid to late winter.
Okay.
But usually the heavy bloom is in the fall, and then you have a few scattered blooms maybe in mid to late winter.
Okay. All right. I was just curious if somehow the impatience had affected it.
No. They're just basically living together, but they're not influencing each other.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Oh, thanks, Denise. Oh, Richard, you just had to have the scientific answer to that. I was hoping for some crazy thing that we've discovered on Hort Day.
Nope.
All right. Glenn from Des Moines has a question about magnolia trees. Hi, Glenn.
Hi there. Last year I noticed some spalling and some cracking in the bark of my magnolia. I think it's a star magnolia tree. And then over the winter with all the snow and the ice, we had a major amount of limb damage and we had to remove a bunch of limbs from that tree. So now I've got kind of two things I'm worried about, and I want to save this tree. Is there something I should do to maintain that? Any suggestions?
Well, you really can't do much about the cracking of the bark or the loose bark on the tree. But if you have broken branches, make a nice clean cut and basically make it at a logical point on the tree. For example, if it's a side branch that broke off, then prune that branch back to the main branch and make a nice clean cut.
Okay.
If it's a main branch, then maybe cut that branch back to a nice vigorous side branch. So basically prune these off at a logical point and make sure you have a nice clean cut, because that nice clean cut will heal faster than a jagged wound on the tree itself.
Yeah.
So
yeah, some of those are very long and tall. They vertical limbs have broken and they sheared off, so it is a long scar. So yeah, I'll cut those back.
Yeah, so try to cut back to logical points on the tree. You can still do that anytime in the next 2 or 3 weeks. There's no need to put on any pruning paint or anything of that nature. Just make a nice clean cut. And basically what you do want to do is make the cut just beyond the branch collar. There's kind of a swelling where it's attached to the actual main branch. Cut it off just beyond that point, and you're basically done.
Okay, leave the collar. Anything an arborist could do, should I have them look at it as far as the bark and the, you know, there's some peeling bark?
There's probably not much they could do on that. That would indicate, for some reason, the tissue beneath the bark has died in certain areas, and now the bark is loose and cracking. I'm not sure why that happened, but there's not much you can do, and I don't think an arborist could do much either. Now, if you had a branch that was cracking or maybe splitting, maybe an arborist could maybe do some cabling and bracing, but I don't think that's the issue here.
No, okay.
All right. Good luck, Glenn. Thanks so much for your call. Now, before, we were talking about community-supported agriculture, which connects individuals with local farmers in the area. And Luke from Davenport has a comment. Hi, Luke.
Hi. I just want to say, growing up in Chicago, I never really was in touch with my local food source until I went to Scattergood French School in Iowa. And they participate in the CSA. But just going there, I learned so much about the nutritional value of your food, and being part of a CSA is pretty much the fastest way to get the freshest food to the consumer without having your produce go through distribution and all that. And my family now they're all very happy participants in CSAs in their local areas.
Oh, great. Well, thank you so much for your comment, Luke. Well, let's go to email. Lynn in Iowa County said, I've been told not to prune anything, shrubs and trees this spring because of the anticipated drought this year, that it encourages growth, and that's not good if there's no water. Do you agree? She said she's been pruning some things already.
I don't agree, no. So I would proceed as normal, basically.
Okay, thanks, Lynn, for your comment. Josh in Iowa City also emailed. He said, last fall I planted some saplings, hybrid gingos and hybrid fruitless cottonwoods with 3 to 5 diameter trunks. This winter, some deer girdled these newly planted trees. Is there anything I can do this spring to salvage them?
Again, basically, you really can't do much once the injury has occurred. I guess what I would do is wait and see what they do. If they have damaged one side of the trunk, but the other side is still basically intact, undamaged, that tree should survive. It's been badly damaged, but it should survive. Now, if they've gone all the way around it, where they have rubbed off the bark all the way down to the wood, and they've gone all the way around it, then that tree probably will die. But I'd kind of wait and see what it does this coming year, and then proceed as far as maybe putting something around those trees this fall to make sure it doesn't happen again.
Mm. Now we just have a few minutes left. We're going to go back to the phones here. Michelle from Granger. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. I was a member of a CSA for the last 2 years, and we really enjoyed it. We tried a lot of new vegetables that we hadn't tried before. But one comment I wanted to make was there's been a lot of talk about how the weather affects CSAs, and my experience was that like last year, the strawberries were damaged early in the season, but despite that, a different crop was prolific later on. Like a certain variety of tomatoes just went crazy. So even though the weather affected one thing negatively, I think it affected different things positively. So to me, the overall experience was positive. And I did have a question I wanted to ask about whether most CSAs are certified organic, or if there's a variety of options?
That's a very good question. There are a variety of options available. And as a consumer, you need to shop around to find the CSA that best fits your needs or your desires for your cropping systems. For example, if you want a certified organic, there are certified organic CSAs, and they do advertise certified organic. There are those who grow natural. In other words, they are not certified, but they use natural products or maybe organic certified products, but they don't hold that certified organic title and certification. Then there are those that are traditional, that use non-organic pesticides. Maybe they use an integrated pest management production strategy, but they're not organic or even natural, as so to speak. So there are a wide variety of different production systems. So make sure when you contact a CSA, ask them what their philosophies are in production, and go from there.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. I want to thank you for your questions and comments, and thank my guests, Linda Knave and Richard Duran of Iowa State University Extension. Thank you both for joining us today.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance day from Alyssa Weiss in Ames. You are always welcome to send your comments and questions about this program. Contact us at any time at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Emily Woodbury. Charity Unebi will be back on Monday with home improvement expert Bill McAnally. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.